From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week, we're bringing back some of our favorite interviews from the past year. But don't worry, you can catch all new arts interviews from 11 to 2 when we'll be live at the 51st Annual Panrod Arts Fair. It's all arts all the time, plus, what'll we do? Right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today we're revisiting some of our favorite interviews from the past few months. First up, Justin Vining and Benny Sanders are two local artists who met last year and bonded over their love of painting outdoors in the plein air style. Together they've been lugging supplies and trekking to some of Indy's prettiest and grittiest spots. The result is a creative friendship and a slew of landscape paintings that harken back to Hoosier painter T.C. Steele while still being rooted in the present. Contributor Ben Schein sat down with this duo to talk about their artistic adventures together.
The story of you guys is that you have this sort of painter-artist bromance going on around plein air painting, where you guys go out and paint outdoors together every spare minute you have. How did you guys meet and decide to start painting together?
I actually met Justin. He was painting at my job out in my parking lot. And I had started oil painting the week before I met Justin Vining. And he showed up, and he was setting up to paint out in the parking lot. And I went out there, and I said, don't paint in the parking lot. Cars are going to start parking here. Paint in the garden. And I brought him some coffee and, like, a croissant or a scone or something. And then I kept coming out and checking on him to see what was going on with his painting. And I thought he was painting the building. I thought he was painting my job, and I was like, this guy's painting like this kitschy restaurant. And then I noticed that he was actually painting another building next to it. He'd seen this reflection in one of the windows, and he wanted to stop by and catch that reflection in like a plein air painting. And I thought that was really neat. I was working in a studio painting out of my head, and Justin invited me to start painting outside with him. I think he was painting out like two paintings a day every day at that time.
Pretty much how I remember it. I was pretty psyched that he brought me free coffee and a scone. And I was there the week before, and it was really weird how it just sort of happenstance happens when you least expect it. And the week before, I was sitting there eating breakfast at Milktooth, and the reflection, I couldn't stop staring at it, the bright blue sky, and went back and painted it and met this guy, and he came out the first time we painted together. We were under this bridge, and it smelled kind of like
urine.
Yeah. It did. And then Benny made an awesome, awesome painting, and we've been painting together pretty often since.
So plein air painting, for people who might not be so familiar with the term plein air, what does it mean?
So it's a French term. It essentially means in open air. So you're outside on location painting what you see.
So if our listeners wanted to go see famous examples, you know, if they went to the IMA, are there famous examples of plein air paintings out there, or is there?
I'm trying to think at the IMA. Do you know, did George Ennis paint his on site?
George Ennis did not paint on site.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
He's more of a studio painter.
Or is there a famous Hoosier plein air painter that everybody knows?
The Hoosier group, T.C. Steele, William Forsyth, all those guys, a lot of them painted on location, well-known for the Brown County, Nashville area in particular. So, I mean, yeah, there's some of those paintings at the IMA for sure.
Do you see yourselves as kind of part of the T.C. Steele and the Hoosier legacy, would you say?
It might be premature to say that.
Totally inspired by.
Yeah, I super inspired by that whole era of art and have started a collection of it in my studio. And so I display some of that original work on the walls. So definitely inspired and, you know, to become a part of that long-term legacy someday. I mean, certainly that's a goal.
Well, how many paintings do you think you guys have done together? I mean, you started this last August, is that right?
Yep.
How many paintings do you think you've completed together?
I'd say upward to 100, 120?
Sounds right-ish. And at least five that I know of we worked on together.
That's right. Like you finished it and handed it off to each other?
Totally.
Yeah, seven or eight, yeah.
Well, what's it like painting with somebody else? Because mostly I've always considered painters to work in kind of a solitary realm, and you guys go out and you're elbow to elbow painting right next to each other. What have you guys learned?
It's kind of great because we paint in some pretty sketchy areas, and it's always good to have someone else that's kind of lumbering there by your side. It's great. I just started oil painting last July, so I get to kind of ask him questions about what he's using, what mediums, how he's getting his lights and darks to work, how he's kind of explaining different things in the landscape on his canvas, and I can kind of look over his shoulder and kind of copy what he's doing and kind of use it for myself, and then I'm pretty much at will to let him use whatever he thinks is cool that I'm doing.
So if Benny's learning technique from you, Justin, what do you think you're learning from Benny?
Well, I would say my approach is maybe more technical and academic, whereas Benny is very, and I don't throw this term around lightly, but naturally gifted. I mean, the dude can paint, and especially for such a short amount of time. I really, it's hard to explain exactly what I've learned, but I've certainly learned a ton. And I think since August, the evolution of my work, I wouldn't say that it's starting to look like Benny's by any means, but I mean, I certainly think you can see that influence of his work in mine.
Yeah, I've been watching you guys on social media since you started it, and they are starting to look similar, but I think they're starting to look like landscapes.
Yeah.
You know. How do you pick the places you go to paint? Like, what makes a great spot to paint? And do you guys agree on that?
We agree for the most part. I think the most important thing is not to get caught up in driving around for an hour and a half looking for a place to paint. So we've got some kind of go-tos, the White River. I like to paint in places that are kind of open. I'm not terribly interested in painting architecture. And I do sometimes, and I learn a lot from it. But so I usually like to paint in open places, big fields, White River, anywhere that's got an opening that I can kind of catch something atmospheric rather than architecture.
Yeah, I really paint every day. So sometimes when we go out with Benny, it's nice just not to choose. I've become less picky about where I paint, and I'm just excited to get out and paint. So decisiveness is sometimes good.
It's usually a quick text message like, do you want to paint today? Yes. Where do you want to paint? I don't care. We painted here before. Let's try to get across on the other side of the river and paint there.
So you guys don't just paint together. You both are busy in your solo careers. What do you guys have going on this month?
This is a big month for me, my busiest of the year. Broad Opal Art Fair, obviously a big one. I have a solo exhibit at the Speedway Art Center opening up. I'll have probably about 20 to 30 paintings on display there.
That opens on Carb Day?
It does, Carb Day, May 26th.
That's fun.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about that. And then this summer, I'll be working at Butler University. I'm doing a gigantic mural in Clues Hall. It's wow. 20 feet wide, 40 feet tall. So that'll take most of summer. And then it'll bring into August and, you know, more shows with the Indie Parks and then Penrod and Hoosier Salon. The list keeps going.
And Benny, you have your own studio, Standard Studios, but you're also showing this summer. So what do you have going on in your studios, and what do you have going on in your own exhibition schedule?
Up until now, I've been exhibiting my own work in my studio for the past 3 months. I'm working on studio paintings for a big show that I'm doing, a solo show at the Indianapolis Art Center that opens June 9th, titled Cast Land. It's a large kind of landscape studio paintings. But I have an artist coming in from New York City named Tess McCallick. She'll be showing at my gallery, Standard Studio Gallery in Garfield Park, on May 5th. And then next month, the beginning of June, I'm going to have a kind of a curated retrospective from local artist and writer John Clark.
Well, that's really exciting, you guys. Thanks for both coming in today, and thanks for sharing your special abilities and talents with us.
Thank you.
Contributor Ben Schein with painters Justin Vining and Benny Sanders. See Justin's work at justinvining.com, and Vining is V-I-N-I-N-G, so justinvining.com, and check out Benny Sanders' work at bennysanders.com. Benny is B-E-N-N-Y. Let's talk about bees. We wanted to hear Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talk about bees with Kate Fransman of Bee Public.
Tell me a little bit about sort of like the current state of bees, because I know we've all been worried for a fairly long time.
Many years, yeah. For over 10 years, we've been talking about colony collapse disorder quite a bit. I remember my first job out of college was at Nouveau. I remember being exposed to it back then, and it actually hasn't dwindled too much, and that's just one factor in honeybees and other pollinators' decline. But unfortunately, we have not seen the statistics get much better. So the stats for this last year haven't come out yet. They come out around this time each year. But for 2015, 2016, we saw, and this is among commercial honeybee hives, mm-hmm. Because, of course, commercial beekeepers are keeping track, we saw a 44% die-off rate. And if we saw that kind of loss in any other agricultural endeavor, we would freak out.
Exactly. So, so it isn't rebounding. They haven't gotten better.
Not significantly, no. And so I think the 2015-2016 season was the worst on record since keeping track.
Now, what is being done about that on a bigger scale?
So one thing that beekeepers can do, commercial beekeepers keep the European honeybee. They're the ones that can be managed. There are around 2,000 other species of native bees in the United States. Some of them are even better pollinators than honeybees, but because we've learned to manage them and keep them in one space, these are the ones we're kind of talking about. So beekeepers can take a hive that has survived. So maybe they've had a bad year and lost quite a few. They can take the hives that have survived and split them in two, which is actually something that honeybee colonies do naturally.
They do that, right? They split apart.
Which is why maybe you see a swarm in your backyard occasionally in the springtime, actually around this time of year. And I think that when the rain stops, we'll start to see some more swarming action happening. So those are reproductive swarms that happen naturally. But beekeepers can actually manually split the hives so they can recoup their losses to some point. But again, these are European honeybees and not our native pollinators.
Right. Now, you know, on that bigger scale, are there successes happening? Are we making any progress?
I wouldn't say there's too much progress in actually creating more pollinators, but I would say that the awareness has increased significantly. And I just noticed this on an anecdotal level. Social media has been great for this. Save the Bees campaign that's just everywhere, even giant corporations
like
Cheerios,
the people, right, with their Where's the Bee campaign.
They're
right?
trying to take advantage of that as well. And so I think that in that regard, it is on people's minds. So I hope that habits then change and we see a cultural shift that supports that. Like we've seen in other countries, in Europe, they've banned certain pesticides that have been proven to be harmful to bees specifically. And we've seen their numbers of pollinators increase over time.
So that has had an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Is there hope that that could happen here? I know we haven't really had a lot of luck in getting rid of some of those mm-hmm. pesticides.
Yeah, I think, and we're seeing it on a city-by-city level, which is great.
Oh, no, that's interesting.
So, for example, Indianapolis last year passed a resolution urging all of our city departments to refrain from using a certain class of pesticides called neonicotinoid pesticides, which are proven to kill bees. And so we didn't pass an ordinance or a law that says you cannot use it, which in Maryland, they actually did do that.
The whole state?
The whole state of Maryland, you cannot get neonicotinoid pesticides there. And here in Indiana, you can buy them at Lowe's and Home Depot for commercial purposes. So we're seeing more and more cities jump on that bandwagon of passing pollinator-friendly legislation, and Indianapolis is kind of at the forefront of that. So I'm hoping that we'll go even further in the near future to maybe ban some of these nasty pesticides.
Well, now that is at least optimistic. Mm-hmm. You know, that there are some things that can be done at least on local levels.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me what you're doing and what you started in the organization that you are running to help
the
bees.
So my organization is called Bee Public. I started it about 5 years ago. Part of it is keeping beehives, like they sort of look like filing cabinets, those traditional beehives, in very public spaces. So there's one along the Monon Trail,
right,
across from Public Greens, one on the Sky Farm at Eskenazi Hospital. I'm helping to manage the hives at the IMA this year and to do some programming. There's an education component to all of this as well. So the first part is these hives where you might not normally find a beehive. Usually they're hidden away. They're on a farm or they're in someone's backyard.
Right, tucked away somewhere.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't get that chance to see the bees just doing their own thing. And so we all have this fear, right, instinctually of getting stung.
Right.
And my belief is that if you can see a beehive just operating as it does, the bees are doing their own thing. They're very gentle. They don't want to come after you and sting you. They will only sting as a last resort in defense. And so to show people that in a beautiful spaces that we have beautiful urban farms and gardens around Indianapolis. So putting hives there for people to see and experience. And then also I go around and talk to classrooms. So I talk to kids about bees and their importance and why you don't need to be afraid and the connection to our food system.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Local artist Sylvia Gray always wanted to be a painter. She loved the landscapes of the Impressionists and the detail of Disney illustrators, but it took her nearly 40 years and a push from her son to pursue her dream. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer recently learned more.
Yeah, sure. When I did this interview with Sylvia and Sean, it was last fall, and they were getting ready for a duo show up at Inspiration Gallery in Carmel. They still have their work up there off and on, and actually you see Sylvia's work all over town. And when you see her beautiful, lush landscapes and those gorgeous silk scarves that she paints and jackets, it's so hard to see that she was really a reluctant artist, but it actually took real life lessons enable her to just pursue her dream.
Well, I have a tremor. It's a natural tremor, and it made me afraid to do anything in front of people. It seemed like people would make fun of me, or I was afraid they were, and I was afraid to show my art. Also because I thought it was a gift and that you didn't have to work at it. But in time I realized that you did have to work on art to get better. And it was something that I could improve on. I had an autistic son and he was not shy. In fact, he would always ask people for things that he wanted, and I found that he would usually get them. And he did a lot of things that I thought were kind of embarrassing, but I realized that I lived through it, and if I could live through some of the things that he did, I would be able to do art in front of, I would be able to go to school and take art classes.
And Sean, it's kind of your fault that your mom is a great artist. What a wonderful thing you taught her. You like to create pottery?
Art class, yes.
You see the bowl go from nothing to become something.
Yes, and customers look at it. And the customers look at it, be like this one.
And Sylvia, how have you seen Sean change since he's been involved making the pottery?
It gave him a lot of self-confidence. His very first art fair, He was at the Indianapolis Arts Center, and he stood up on the table when he had one last piece, and he said to the crowd, this is my last piece. Come and buy it now. He sold everything. I did notice that when he was in a school environment, teachers always sent him into time out, or I would get phone calls about how he was misbehaving, or they would send him home. But when he would go to art camps, and when he took classes at the Indianapolis Arts Center, no one complained about him. It was like they put up with his hyperactivity and his questions, and they always would tell me what a good student he was. And so that's kind of why I started thinking, oh, art must be the thing for him.
So what kind of bowls are you working on right now?
Big bowls and small bowls and Peggy's cross.
And you also make installations.
Cups.
Well, you make some large pieces.
And cups.
With discs.
And cups.
Coffee cups.
And chalices, goblets. Mm-hmm. The priest did it. I make a priest a chalice. Fall.
What items do you sell the most of?
Bowls.
Why do you think that is?
The customers like it.
And how has working through his journey through art affected your own personal journey through art as well?
Well, one thing I did learn from him is persistence, because he is very tenacious and persistent. When he wants something, he will drive someone crazy till he gets it. And it was just a matter of being honest with myself. And I am a really honest person, and so I just let it go.
And if you come out to Penrod today, Saturday the 9th, Sylvia is probably here. She usually attends Penrod and has her paintings and her silk scarves for sale. Otherwise, she has a Facebook page that you can go to find out where her latest collection is going to be. The same with Sean. It's Sean Patrick Gray on Facebook. Two very talented artists right here from Indianapolis.
Fantastic. Lots of pretty things going on around and about town on this Penrod weekend, but we have even more to share with you on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
So wool sculpture, what does that mean? Those words don't normally go together, but there's an artist around Indy named Gary Schmidt who actually has a show that's just opened in Greenfield, and it's at the 20 North Gallery, and he specializes in hard-edged, fully needle-felted wool fiber sculpture. And if you can't picture what that is, that's all the more reason to go check out Gary Schmidt's wool sculpture exhibit at 20 North Gallery in Greenfield.
Last First Friday, I trekked up to Fountain Square to visit the Circle South Gallery. They are located at 1315 South Shelby Street. They're just south of the Cat Cafe, which I know you know where that is, Sharon, of course. And they have a wonderful show up this month, all through the month of September, these amazing Latino artists that are doing acrylics and oil and just super powerful, expressive
images. And at the same time, they are running a mini Latino film festival on Tuesday nights as well. So they start at 6:30 and they run till 9 o'clock. So you can go there, you can see the art, you can see the film. And it's just a great new place to check out up in Fountain Square. It's the Circle South Gallery. And of course, they have a Facebook page, Circle South Indie, to find out more about the artists and the films.
So it's hard to believe, but it's been nearly 500 years since Martin Luther took a stand and nailed his treatises to a door. And I'm telling you this because you'll hear about a lot of performances relative to that event. For example, on Friday, September 22nd and Sunday, September 24th, the Hendrix Symphony Orchestra presents the Reformation Symphony. That's the Felix Mendelssohn Symphony commemorating the event I was just talking about. All sorts of other targeted programming on that same program, and you can find out more about that at hendrixsymphonic.org.
When you listen to us later today, when we're out at Penrod, we're going to be talking with Rob Dixon and Mark Sheldon about the Indie Jazz Fest, but you need to get your tickets now because they are going to start going fast once you hear about the big lineup of the great selection of musicians they have coming to town, IndieJazzFest.net. You're going to want to hear Tony Monaco. He's that great B3 Hammond organist that's playing. Kirk Whalum, he's been playing with everybody lately. If you listen to any of the jazz shows out there, you know that this guy is everywhere. Well, he's coming to Indianapolis on the 16th as part of the Indie Jazz Fest. Sullivan Fortner, the former the APA Jazz pianist winner, he's going to be performing on the 23rd. And that block party is a must attend, and the tickets are going quickly for that. That's on the 24th, 12 bands, 3 p.m. to 2 a.m., all different kinds of food and music. Make sure you get your IndieJazzFest.net tickets today.
And if you're out at Penrod, come by and say hi to us. We're broadcasting live from 11 to 2 on this Saturday, September 9th. And don't forget to hit up all the booths and get your schedules for the upcoming year. And you can also learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us again next week for our calendar we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Gamble. If you're a writer in central Indiana, you either know about the writers' collective known as the Geeky Press, or you should. The Geeky Press holds writers' retreats and readings, does a podcast called The Downtown Writers' Jam, publishes a literary magazine, and so much more. Contributor Mark Allen sat down with the Geeky Press's Brad King to talk about all the things that he and the Geeky Press do.
We should start with an introduction. So explain Geeky Press. How old is it? Where did it come from? What you been doing?
So I came to Indianapolis about 8 years ago. And at the other cities that I'd lived in, Austin, San Francisco, always had these big writing centers, these places where people could write. And we have the Indiana Writer Center up in Broad Ripple, but there wasn't anything downtown and where you could gather with writers and do things. So I literally just started this about 2.5 years ago, hosting readings over at Indie Reads Books. And they were popular. We had 70 or 80 people showing up for the readings and kind of built from there and added three other partners along the way. So there's four of us now who do a variety of things. We host readings, we do writing retreats, we publish books, and we're doing our first literary magazine, which is coming out on May 19th.
So what's the state of writing in Indianapolis?
It's interesting because when Emily Taylor took over at Nouveau, she covers literary arts there, she said, I know there's a lot of stuff going on here, but there's not really a place where it's all gathered up. And I said, yeah, I've had the same problem. And as we've started doing things, we've found we have more than 350 people on our list We've had about 150 riders participate in our events, either as readers or at the retreats. We had about 100 submissions for the literary magazine. When we do our anthology books, we've had more than 200 submissions to both of them. So there are a lot of people that are in various states of their career, you know, everything from new riders to mid-career folks to people like me who've doing it professionally for, you know, 20 years. So there is a lot of folks who are not only writing, but who are interested in sort of gathering and meeting other writers and producing things across all kinds of genres. What's interesting, I think, with the Geeky Press is that we've gone out of our way to, we have playwrights. There's a huge theater playwriting scene here. We've gone out and gotten a bunch of folks from the improv comedy because they write on stage, right? Like they don't put it on a page, but what they're doing is writing, along with traditional fiction and nonfiction and poetry folks. So we have a really diverse group of people, and we're moving into the, this may seem odd, but we are moving into the spoken word as well, which is not that different from improv in that it, a lot of it is, it's written, but it's still performed and it is meant to be live writing. So there's a lot of stuff happening. You can do something around the literary arts pretty much every day of the week here.
That's pretty amazing because I don't think of us necessarily that way, but maybe you're encouraging it, right? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I talked to Brian Payne, who's over at CICF a few times, and I said, and the Arts Council of Indianapolis, Shannon and Dave, and I said, you know, we do a really good job with visual arts. We do a really good job with music, but the space for writing isn't, it hasn't been carved out in the same kind of way. And we actually work with Shannon and Dave over at the Arts Council now. Like we have a joint happy hour where we bring our writers together with their visual artists to try to get that cross-pollination going. So I think that the problem has been not that people didn't want to write or that they didn't want to gather, was that there weren't really a group of writers taking ownership of doing that. So you had the library doing, you know, bringing folks in, and you had the theater folks sort of existing in their space, but there wasn't a lot of let's bring all this together. Mm-hmm. And really that has been our superpower at the Geeky Press. And as I've gone out and gotten partners, I've looked for people who are different than me. I've looked for people that are in different genres that do different stuff than I do, because that's how you make it work.
Yeah. And you do a lot of different events. So let's talk about a few things that you do. One of them, the literary magazine. So that's new?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So May 19th is our first issue. And we, you know, I sort of have a mantra in life, which is make a thing. Like if you want something to exist, you got two choices, right? You can either hope somebody comes up with that or you can do it. And so,
what about complain? You can complain too.
I find that other people tend to tell us what we've done wrong, which is fine. Like that's part of making things, right? Is creating these conversations around stuff. So the literary magazine, you know, we're working with Bouch Books Indie. So that's Jessica Dyer, who works with small presses and takes books and puts together these pop-up bookstores. And she and Nicole Matthew, who's one of our partners, did the poetry section. Elise Lockwood, who is involved in theater, did our, you know, got our playwrights. And Amber Peckham and I worked on the fiction and nonfiction. So we just decided, like, we're just going to put this call out and see what happens. What's the worst that can happen? Like, if nobody shows up, we don't have a magazine. And it turns out we had, you know,
you have
about
a
150. Yeah, we had a, and we've already started getting submissions for fall. So we're kind of freaking out because we have to read all these and organize them. And, you know, it's a loose configuration of folks that do this. But my old boss used to call that a high class problem, right? So we do that. And that's sort of an offshoot of these anthology books that we do. So we actually also publish books where we pick a topic and say, submit stuff. So I can't give you the title of the first one, but it was Bad Jobs and BS. and it was essentially just people writing stories, you know, fiction, poetry, nonfiction, plays about terrible jobs and awful things that happen to them. Yeah.
You do retreats for writers, and they can be a day-long mm-hmm. thing. That was the one that I went to. But you also have a weekend-type thing, too.
We do. We do monthly, like, 1 to 2 hour events at coffee shops just to get people together. They're called Writing Hacks. We do quarterly writing retreats, and we've done them for a day, so like 8:30, 9:30 to 4:30. We're going to start doing them half days because we feel like that is I like to write for 8 hours, but it turns out most people have lives, and about 4 hours is a good amount of time for them. And we've done them, you know, we did one at the Columbia Club. We did one at the Speakeasy. We just kind of like bounce around in places that are quiet where we can have space. And then we do a yearly writing retreat down at Bradford Woods. That's 3 days.
Yeah, and you've made these really affordable, I think. I mean, I think the event I went to cost all of $10.
$10.
And I know that retreat is $95,
yeah,
right? So very much affordable.
Yeah, the nice, well, I mean, we're not. It's not a business, right? So, like, if we cover costs, I'm happy. On the writing retreats, I cover most of the costs. Like, I pay for a little bit of that, but that's, you know, if you're going to make something like that, we're trying to build a community and not trying to make money off the community.
Brad King with contributor Mark Allen. Learn more about the Geeky Press at thegeekypress.com. This month, the Indiana Repertory Theater celebrates James Still's 20th anniversary as its playwright in residence. That's an almost unheard of longevity for a relationship between a theater and a writer. I invited James and Executive Artistic Director Janet Allen to talk about their relationship and how IRT audiences have profited from their rich history together.
You guys have a long and happy marriage now. 2 decades.
Aww.
It's almost 2 decades.
They're
pointing and gritting. Tell me about your first date. How'd you meet?
Oh, I could do that, Sharon. James always rolls his eyes because he always says all my thinking about this is revisionist. But
you say that like it's a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. You're right. Somebody, and I don't know who the somebody was, it might have been Dorothy Webb, said, Janet, you need to walk down the hall to the cabaret and meet this playwright named James Still, because we are working on a play of his. This was back in the days of the old Bonderman Youth Playwriting Symposium, Sharon,
right.
Back in the day. I don't know what year it was.
1991.
See, he knows all the facts.
Wow.
I just know everything else. And meet him. And so I did, and I liked him. And I saw his play, which was a hour-long version of Amber Waves.
Mm-hmm.
That you developed at the Kennedy Center,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
B, read it, was one of the winners of that round. And then I started reading other plays of his, and we produced, the first play of his we produced was Secret History of the Future in what year, James?
1993.
Okay. Which was Columbus happening upon the Americas time. Mm-hmm. We did that play. That's when you and I really started talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was living in New York then. It was long before the internet. So we had an old-fashioned,
we wrote letters.
You know, U.S.
We
post
did.
Office relationship.
Epistolary romance.
Yes.
I love
I wonder
it.
If
yes.
we I wonder if I have any of that, James. I bet I do.
Yeah, I probably do somewhere in the archives.
Gosh, this sounds like the stuff of a play itself.
James actually taught me how to email, Sharon. He was much more internet and email savvy long before I was, and he sort of kindly mostly coerced me.
Those were in the days when we had so few people who did email. I actually knew everyone's email addresses by heart.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, you know, it wasn't like you had 1,000 or 3,000 or whatever.
And honestly, that really wasn't all that long
ago. It wasn't.
No.
It wasn't.
So what is the function of a playwright in residence? Why do, and I want to ask each of you to tell me this, and don't compare notes.
Well, I'll just say, I mean, I think the advantage we've had is that I had never been a playwright in residence at any theater, and the IRT had never had a playwright in residence.
Uh-huh.
So actually, we really made it up.
You had a blank slate.
And we did. Mm-hmm. And I think that was actually important. And I think it was also part of our initial success, is that we didn't come in thinking it had to be one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were all sort of pretty open-hearted, but, you know, also a little like, huh, I wonder what this is going to be, and will it be useful to anyone involved? And initially, my time at the IRT was funded by a 2-year grant from the Pew Charitable Trust. And so honestly, in the beginning, I was just looking at 2 years. What would it mean to be the playwright in residence for 2 years at the Indiana Repertory Theater? And the answers to that question then is different than what does it mean to be the playwright in residence over 20 seasons. I think for me, too, at that time in my life, I had worked in a lot of theaters as a freelance writer, and I was looking, I'd often had really meaningful experiences, but I was looking for an ongoing experience where I wasn't always the guest. No matter how well I was treated, at the end of the day, I was the guest, and you never knew if you'd get to go back and, you know, sit at that table again with all those nice people. And so the idea of being the playwright in residence was also, how could this be an ongoing relationship? When I say ongoing relationship, it was also a hunger for an ongoing relationship with an audience. That's one of the most spectacular things about being the playwright in residence for 20 years is that my plays have had an ongoing conversation with our audience for 20 years. And that's really special.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to that. But why have a playwright in residence?
It happened simultaneously, Sharon, with me becoming artistic director. And I was trying to figure out what kind of artistic director I wanted to be. And as a former dramaturg, you can't take the dramaturg out of the girls, so I'm still a dramaturg. I wanted to develop new work. And I had spent a lot of time watching my two mentors, Libby Apple and Tom Haas, my predecessors in the role, sort of stagger through the quagmire of developing new work and what kind of new work hits and what kind of new work really interests artists more than audiences. And so I was looking for a collaborator to figure out how to create new work that was important to a community, not just important to artists. Artists need to develop new work to oil those muscles, to flex those muscles, and to have something to say to the bigger world. But audiences want a good play, and they want a good play they care about.
Yeah.
So that was, I wanted a collaborator to help me figure out that. And in that, James had two very particular attributes. I don't think I knew this consciously, but certainly unconsciously. One, he's from the Midwest. He's from a small town in Kansas. He'd lived in Chicago. He'd lived in New York. He'd lived in L.A. He's lived in Seattle since this. So he's lived all over the place. But those flyover zone routes were very important to me because he and I shared a real deep passion for the fact that the people in the Midwest do not see stories about themselves. And, you know, we would say, gosh, the only popular culture reference points anybody had in our lives was you used to talk about Green Acres.
And Hee-Haw.
Hee-Haw. And I used to talk about the Roseanne show set in Northern Indiana, you know, sitcoms that have nothing really to do with culture. So that was one attribute. The other one was that James wrote, even before he was playwright in residence, across the whole spectrum of audience to which we reach, that is children and adults, and children in lots of different ages. I mean, the Velveteen Rabbit that we did a couple of years ago of his way predates his relationship to us. So he literally has written for the youngest of our constituents to the oldest and everything in between. That was pretty conscious to me because I couldn't form a long relationship, I thought, with a writer who was only niched for adults or only niched for kids. So we just kind of dove into this and said, what do we want it to be?
It strikes me that the governor should give you an honorary Hoosiership, whatever it is.
I'm an honorary citizen of Indianapolis.
Yeah, he got some things on his 10th anniversary. We'll see what the 20th brings.
who is the audience here? Who have you come to identify as people who live in central Indiana?
Well, I'm always careful not to think of an audience as monolithic. I've learned, our audience is, as Janet has said, they're all ages. They come from all over central Indiana. Of course, a lot are from Indianapolis. And I've gotten to know many of them personally. I've had dinner in their homes. I've watched their kids grow up. I've gone to high school plays of their kids. They certainly have supported my work in the various things that I've done at the IRT. But I think, not surprisingly, the audience is as varied as this country is. And that's important to me. And I think that's also another reason why the IRT produces often 9 plays over our season. And usually, a pretty broad variety of plays. It covered different genres, different time periods, and that's all very purposeful. And that's connected to, again, the audience being extremely diverse and interesting to me. And I think, again, I spend time, audiences are mysterious to me, no matter wherever, whether it's the IRT or someplace else. Every time I'm sitting in an audience of my own plays, I sit in the back and I think, wow, these people are here tonight to see this thing that I dreamt up at some point that a long time ago was just this feeling or this idea. And here they are. And we're all going to sit in the dark and we're all going to watch this and feel this story. When I think about the audience in that way, it's a very spiritual, mysterious experience.
Janet Allen is the Indiana Repertory Theater's Executive Artistic Director, and James Still has been their playwright in residence for 2 decades. You can see their 2017-2018 season at irtlive.com. A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks 5 songs with an interesting community member each week, and we wanted to hear his conversation with Reverend James Davis again.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I want to share an excerpt of an interview I recently recorded with Reverend James Davis of the Indianapolis vocal group The Vanguards. In 1970, The Vanguards scored a national top 40 R&B hit with their ballad, It's Too Late for Love. It's too late. Reverend James Davis was the lead vocalist and founder of The Vanguards, and he joins us now to share his thoughts on 5 classic tunes from The Vanguards. We talked about Somebody Please. How do you feel about when you hear that song today?
Well, it brings back memories. I don't talk about that one much.
Okay. That was about somebody in particular, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was. You know how young puppy love is in high school. It was about a heartbreak. Somebody please. So that's the most out.
That's why there's so much feeling in it, because it was right. Something you were actually experiencing when you created it.
I did.
One of my favorite up-tempo Vanguards records, which was the B-side, I think, to It's Too Late for Love, is The Thought of Losing Your Love, which is a real up-tempo number. What do you remember about that one?
It was, if you notice, the most of those songs were heartbreak-type blues.
Yeah.
Rhythm and blues, and it was because that was the mood of people my age at the time. We weren't having much success at romance. So every one of those songs were heartbreaking.
Sure.
And that's the best I can really say is the mood of us at that time I was able to tap into.
And that became the trademark sound. When you think of the Vanguards, you think of those ballads of lost love, right?
Right, yeah. Lost love, heartbreak. It should have worked, but it didn't.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> But I believe it's your love that tried to steal, baby. Oh, something about the things you do explains the changes that I go through. You know the thought of losing your And Gotta Have Love is a great song, which is about peace and unity and love. And yeah. What do you remember about that
now,
one?
Now, that band was our other one. Now, we had a band that we worked with from California.
Okay.
That band was from California, from L.A. And we did some recording with them. And that was one of the songs that band wrote.
one of the, my favorite Vanguard's records, and this is a deep one that has deep lyrics, Man Without Knowledge.
Oh, now, that was we call him Moose, Charles Amos. He and I was part of my writing team. We had a little writing team, and Charles Amos wrote that one, The Man Without Knowledge.
Another song that's maybe the most ambitious production with the Vanguards is Girl Go Away.
Again, that was Charles Amos.
And that record, Girl Go Away, has strings in it. It's got a huge production. Yeah. What do you remember about that one?
Well, Herb brought in violins, and it seems to me we recorded at a studio down in Bloomington, Indiana. And it seems to me he brought in these violin players from Indiana University. And I saw these guys come in there with their little violins and their little black suits, and they take one look at your chart and write a score for the violin parts right now and play it right quick and done, gone, see you later. they know music that well.
Thank you, Reverend James Davis, and stay tuned for my full interview with Reverend Davis on an upcoming edition of Cultural Manifesto.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Ben Schein. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. And if you're listening on Saturday morning, come on out to the Penrod Arts Fair on the Newfields campus, the Indianapolis Museum of Art, where we're broadcasting live from 11 to 2. Then tune in next week for stories about a Buck Creek Players production, what life will be like for indie galleries after IDADA's demise, and a weekend devoted to touring our city's greatest landscapes. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.